Genesis 25, and we're reading from verse 19 to 34. This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son, Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the elder will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out, with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." That is why he was also called Edom. Jacob replied, "First, sell me your birthright." "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" But Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright. Now we're back in Genesis. We finished the story of Abraham, and now we come to the life of Isaac and his sons. And when you read the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you have this sense that God is at work. After all, God had made those remarkable promises back in Genesis 12 to Abraham and called Abraham to leave his father's household and to go to a land that God was promising him. And God promised not just land, but many descendants, such that he would become a great nation. And God gave blessing to Abraham and promised great blessings to him. And as you then read the story from Genesis 12 onwards, really you're seeing God beginning to fulfill what he had promised. It takes a long time, it takes many years, but all that happens is the unfolding of God's promise. And of course, God's great plan is that not just would Abraham become a great nation, but from that nation, God would bring a savior. One of Abraham's descendants would bless the world. And that, of course, is Jesus Christ. So these are important stories. But actually, this is a story that we're part of as well. Because Abraham is described as the father of all who believe. Romans 4, verse 16. And a similar idea comes across in Galatians chapter 3. And so we're kind of involved in this, because Abraham and his sons become examples for us to follow. And just as Isaac had to follow his father's footsteps of faith, so we too are called to follow in this path of faith. Now, so many of the stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are really just a kind of everyday life in that kind of community, with herds and flocks, with food and even stew. And it's the kind of, in the everyday experiences of life, that Isaac here is called to put in practice his faith. And so we read of childlessness and of a difficult pregnancy, of sibling rivalry, of love of food, and all these kind of everyday sort of things. And it's in that context that they're to live out their faith in God. Now, verse 19 begins a new section in Genesis. These new sections begin with this line, "This is the account of the family line," and in this case, of Abraham's son, Isaac. Just before this, verse 12, you have a very short section. This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son, Ishmael. And it's a very short account. We don't get much detail of Ishmael. But the thing that we do see there is that God, who had promised even that Ishmael would become a nation, that kings would come from him, we see even here that there were 12 rulers in Ishmael. As if to say, look, if God can keep his promise to Ishmael, who was not the one to receive and inherit the blessings, how much more is God going to keep his promise for Isaac? And so in verse 19, this is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. We're made to think, wow, what is God going to do? Well, God will fulfill his promises to Isaac, and he will most certainly be with Isaac, but it does take time. And things work out over many years in the ordinary family life that Isaac experiences. And we have in this account that we read three challenges that Isaac faces and his family face. And so we're going to think of these three challenges, and we're going to see how their faith needs to work out in each of them. So firstly, we have a reason to pray. So this is our first point, a reason to pray. So on the treasure hunters, children, you'll see that in red, a reason to pray. Now, Isaac had married Rebekah. Everything had gone so well. Do you remember how Abraham sent his servant off to out of the promised land, out of Canaan, back to his home country, to relatives there, and told the servant to bring a wife for his son Isaac from there? And God had directed the steps of the servant, and things had gone well. He came back with Rebekah. And we read at the end of chapter 24 that Isaac loved Rebekah. Isaac was comforted after his mother's death, and things were going well. But then a problem arises. Turns out Rebekah was childless. She couldn't have a child. They wanted a family, but month after month, year after year, there was no baby. Now, that was difficult enough, as it was, but you remember that the promise was that through Isaac, God was going to bring many descendants, a whole nation. And so not only do Isaac and Rebekah want children, but there's this problem of the promise. How is that promise going to be fulfilled through Isaac if they couldn't have children? Now, perhaps for a while, Rebekah and Isaac weren't overly concerned. You know, a lot of couples have to wait. After all, look at what happened to our grandfather, Abraham and Sarah. Think of all the years they waited. Surely God is going to give us a child sooner or later. But still no child was born. And they may well have asked, what is God doing here? Why has God not given us a child? You know, God could have given them a child so much sooner. But God wanted Isaac and Rebekah to wait. Now, Isaac had a remarkable father. Abraham was a man of great faith. And Isaac was ready to live in the blessing of that. It's a huge blessing. Imagine having Abraham as your father. This great man of God, described as the friend of God, someone with whom God spoke, a man of great faith. And Isaac is brought up in that family. And Isaac had been willing to live in the blessings of this faith. When he was a teenager, do you remember how he'd been willing to be tied to the altar when his father Abraham took him up the mountain? And Isaac didn't know what was going to happen. But he lives in this family of faith. He doesn't rebel against it, he accepts it. Of course, in the end, he wasn't sacrificed, and there was a ram that was there instead. But Isaac was willing, as a teenage young man. And Isaac was willing to wait for a godly wife. We read here that he was 40 years old when he married. And so he didn't run after one of the local women who didn't believe in God. He was ready to wait until he was 40. And when he was 40, he married Rebecca, a woman who feared God. And so in one sense, we see Isaac already as a man who believes. But in some ways, it was quite passive. After all, it was Abraham who had the servant bring the wife for him. And Abraham was the one who tied him to the altar. But with this experience of childlessness, Isaac is having to trust in God for himself. Yes, Isaac had a remarkable father. And Isaac was ready to live in the blessings of that household of faith. But he needs to learn to pray for himself. And I think this is why God allows Rebecca to be childless all this time. Isaac has to learn to pray, not just once, but persistently. And so we read in verse 21, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebecca became pregnant. But then when you come to verse 26, after the twins are born, we read this. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebecca gave birth to them. So he was 40 when he got married. He's 60, 20 years later, when his first children are born. In other words, he's having to pray for a very long time. He's having to trust God when he can't see the answer. And so over these years, Isaac is learning to trust God for himself. Over that time, Isaac could have given up hope. He could even have become bitter against God. But instead, he learns to trust God. The promises that God had made to his father Abraham, Isaac was learning to apply to himself. Because God had promised that through Isaac, those descendants would come. And so Isaac reminds God of this promise. Isaac trusts God, and Isaac becomes a man of faith. Now I want to speak to those of you who are younger. You will be very aware of your parents' faith. You know that they believe in God. And perhaps, like Isaac, you appreciate having parents who believe. But maybe you doubt that you could ever be like them. Maybe you think, well, yes, I can see how my mother and father, I can see how mum and dad, they trust God, they pray about things. God answers their prayers. But I could never be like that. Well, Isaac's experience shows that God would have the children of believers learn to trust in him for themselves. Because there comes that point in your life where, though you are blessed through your parents' faith, and it's a huge blessing, you may not always appreciate it, but it's a huge blessing to be brought up by parents who trust in God, who have God's standards as their standards, who trust that God cares, who know that God will answer their prayers. But you need to have faith for yourself in God. And so I want to encourage you You know, you may not have the same challenge that Isaac had, but you will face challenges. We all face challenges, and God allows us to experience these challenges because he wants us to learn to trust him. So is there something that's difficult in your life at the moment? Is there something that you rather wasn't happening? Isaac would have much preferred it if his wife could have had children much sooner. It was difficult for him, but what it did was get him to pray. What it did was get him to learn to trust in God. You see, if God made everything easy for us, we might never really learn to trust him. But it's through the struggles of everyday life that you have the opportunity to look to God. And actually, as we get older, sometimes those struggles and challenges can be even more pressing. Because God wants us to learn to trust him even more. He's always wanting us to grow. And so there are always challenges. Now, I don't mean we feel the same sense of challenge every day of our lives, but don't be surprised if in the coming months there's a fresh challenge in your life. Because God cares about you and he wants you to grow in your faith. And so let me encourage you from a young age. Now, we've got three of the youngest ones here today, Elizabeth, Benji, and Izzy. Even at your age, learn to pray to God until he answers. It might be a little challenge you have at school, something that troubles you. Pray to God about it. Now you can pray with your parents, ask for God's help, and as you see God answering that, it helps you to take those first steps of faith. And you learn then, when the next challenge comes, you think, well, God helped me in that, God can help me in this. I still remember my first day at school. And I didn't know any of the other children in the school, apart from my sister. But she was in a different class, of course. And I didn't have any friends, because I didn't know anyone yet. And I stood in the playground in the corner, and I prayed, please God, give me a friend. And I looked up, and this boy came along, and we became great friends. And in fact, turned out he lived just down the road. And his name was, well, Jonathan. There we go. So, God answers our prayers. God wants us to learn to trust him. So that's a reason to pray. Now, the second challenge was a rivalry. So we've had I've tried to make these all start with the same letter so the young ones can remember. When they're telling their parents what the sermon was about, you've got three things that start with R. We've had a reason to pray. Now we've got a rivalry to restrain. Now, God answered Isaac's prayers, but that was not the end of the challenges that he faced. And what Rebecca faced, particularly Rebecca, because this was a difficult pregnancy. Now, I had to check with Hamara about this one. Apparently, the little kicks that you feel are quite pleasant. At least they were for Hamara. Starts off a little fluttery feeling, was that right, Hamara? And then as the baby gets bigger inside you, the kicks get a bit, sometimes they can be uncomfortable, but as far as I'm aware, no one here has had twins. And no one here has had twins who, from, it seems, the moment of conception, were intense rivals. These two were going at it, hammer and tong, even before they were born. They were grappling with each other. They were assaulting each other. The word is actually quite a strong word here, where it says how they were jostling one another inside her. Well, it drives Rebecca to prayer. She asks God, why is this happening to me? Now, we don't know how God spoke to her. Maybe God spoke one night in a dream, maybe through a prophet, we don't know. But God speaks to her. And it turns out that this struggle between the twins that she's about to bear was just the beginning of a longer struggle. Verse 23, Two nations are in your womb, the Lord said to her, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the elder will serve the younger. These two brothers started out the way they were going to continue. There was going to be intense rivalry between them. And so, even when they're born, though Jacob was the second to come out, there he was grasping the little heel of his brother Esau. You can just imagine it, can't you? The little chubby fingers round the little heel of that baby. Hence his name. Jacob means he grasps. And these two boys were very different, which probably didn't help the distance between them. Now, sometimes opposites can attract. Sometimes people are very similar. They can become competitive over that. But their differences didn't seem to bring them together at all. Esau, we're told, was red and hairy. Hence his name, Esau. It means hairy, or they think it means hairy. And he grew up to become a hunter. He was a man of the outdoors. He was there willing to brave the wild animals. You know, hunting is not a safe activity. If you're hunting a wild boar, for example, you know, those can be really ferocious creatures. But he was a brave man, a man of the outdoors. He was the impetuous, gung-ho sort of guy. And of course, we see that later in the story in verse 30, where he says, quick, let me have some of that red stew, I'm famished. He's the impetuous type, the brave, go for it. Jacob was very different. We read later, he was a smooth man. He wasn't hairy like his brother Esau. And he was the quieter sort. He was content, satisfied to stay at home among the tents, and presumably the herds. So later on, he becomes a herdsman. He's more self-contained. He doesn't feel the need for the adrenaline rush of the hunt. But he's the schemer. He makes his cunning plans so that he can get his way. He's happy for others to do the work so that he can cash in through his schemes. And we see this in verse 31. Sell me your birthright, he says to his famished brother, who wants some of the stew. Now, what are the parents to do? This is a challenge. It's a challenge. Now, of course, most families are quite familiar, if they're more than one child, they're quite familiar with the concept of sibling rivalry. Unless I'm mistaken, it's true every family. You get at least a certain amount of tension and aggro between brothers and sisters, sisters and sisters, brothers and brothers. But there was something different here. There was something more, because God has told Rebekah that these two boys will become two nations, and that the elder is going to serve the younger. In other words, Jacob is going to come out on top. His nation is going to be the favored nation. Now, what should those parents do? Well, surely these parents should help their sons to get along a bit better. After all, if they're going to become the head of nations, their sons are going to be shaping whole people groups. And if these two boys can't get on better, you know, is it going to end up in war between their two nations? And sadly, that's what sometimes happened in centuries later. Between Israel and Edom, as the people of Esau became known, so often there was fighting. They certainly carried on the way they started. So what are the parents to do? Surely they must encourage their boys to get on better. But they don't. You see, Isaac, he loved to eat game. The old translation puts it as venison, but it's probably any selection of wild animals that could be caught. Game meat. And he let his love of meat allow him to favour Esau, because Esau, of course, was the hunter. And when Esau came back with all this meat, wow, it was great for his father Isaac. They would sit, they'd eat together, and their hearts became united. But the subtle message to Esau was that, look, it's okay to let your appetites dictate what you do. Isaac's love of game meat allowed him to favor Esau. And Esau feels, well, that's okay. And so Esau himself becomes someone whose appetite rules him. And we'll see that later with the story of the stew. Now, Rebecca, she favors Jacob. Why does she do this? Maybe in compensation for Isaac's favoring of Esau? Perhaps because of the prophecy. You know, if Jacob is going to become the greater nation, well, I better be on the right side, hadn't I? We don't know. But she, we're told, loves Jacob. And so we have Esau and his father Isaac united in their craving for food. And we have Rebecca and her son Jacob united actually in their scheming. That becomes very much clearer in a later chapter. And through this favoritism, the rivalry is deepened. Instead of helping their boys to get along with each other, the favoritism that Isaac and Rebecca show drives those two boys further apart. Now, here's a message for us as parents. You know, as parents, we often feel that we get it wrong. And maybe your children tell you you get it wrong. We feel we get it wrong so often, I think, as parents, because a huge amount is expected of us. Probably more these days than in previous generations, I don't know. I mean, it's great if you can develop your child's interest in music, sports, take them on educational holidays, supervise their homework, make sure they have their own room, and by the end of it all have a massive deposit for their new home. It's great if you can do all those things. And maybe you feel a failure if you can't do all those things. But always remember as parents that the emphasis on the Bible is on three things for us as parents. Firstly, teach your children God's truth. Bring them up in the way of the Lord. Are you doing that every day? Family devotions, encouraging them to read the Bible and so on. Second thing the Bible has us as parents to do is to train our children to be obedient. There's one command given in the Bible for children, that is, children, obey your parents. Well, they're not going to learn to obey their parents unless the parents ensure they obey. So that's the second thing as parents we need to do. Train our children in obedience. And the third thing is, don't exasperate. Don't embitter your children. So three things. Now, there's one sure way of exasperating and embittering your children, and that is to show favoritism to one of them above another. So the simple message here, make sure as a parent you are even-handed. Even-handed in the gifts that you give, in the things that you buy for them, in the discipline, the way you administer that discipline, in the praise that you give, in the time that you give your children. Try and be even-handed. Now, I'm not saying we can be absolutely identical in everything that we do for our children. That's impossible. They do have different personalities. They do have different needs. But there does need to be that sense of even-handedness. So this was a challenge that, sadly, Isaac and Rebekah failed. They allowed themselves to have their favorites. Right. They do well in the first one. Isaac prays. A reason to pray. He does well. A rivalry to restrain. Sadly, they don't restrain it. Thirdly, a rashness to control. Got your three R's there? A reason to pray, a rivalry to restrain, a rashness to control. Here we come to the story of the stew. Hands up if stew is your favorite food. Not many hands going up. Okay. Do you know, Esau's behavior in these verses is the one thing that the writer of Genesis, Moses, comments on. He's inspired at the end of verse 34 to say, "So Esau despised his birthright." Whenever you have a comment like that in the narrative, it's hugely significant, because they don't often come, and when it's there, it means that's what we're to pick up from this story. Esau is despising his birthright. Actually, the writer to Hebrews also picks up on this story. If you'd like to turn to Hebrews chapter 12, and we'll read verses 16 and 17, and referring back to this story in Genesis 25. So Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 16. "See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterwards, as you know, when he wanted to inherit this blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done." So this is a significant event. It might seem like an everyday family occurrence, someone who's hungry, someone who's cooking some stew. But actually, this became a very significant event. Now, it's not that Jacob was completely innocent in all of this, even though Esau is the main one who is singled out. Jacob, of course, is the schemer. And he seems to have planned his way of getting the birthright. So the story. Esau comes home from hunting. Maybe it's been a difficult hunt. Maybe it's been a very unsuccessful hunt. It's taken him a longer time, perhaps, than normal. And he's absolutely famished when he comes home. A bit like you get home from school. "Mum, where's the cake?" Or whatever else it is you want to eat. Well, he is famished as he comes home from hunting. And he sees that Jacob is cooking some stew. Maybe he can smell it. Maybe it smells so good because he's so hungry. And he asks for some. Notice he calls it red stew. "Quick," verse 30, "let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." Maybe he thinks that there's meat in it because it's red. And he desperately wants to have it. And Jacob, maybe he's been thinking this through, maybe he's seen it happen before. His brother comes home hungry. He's hatched a plan. And so he's ready with his reply in verse 31. "First, sell me your birthright." And you can imagine Jacob just looking down at the stew and stirring it while his famished brother kind of registers what has just been asked. "First, sell me your birthright." Now, Esau was the firstborn. Even though they're twins, one of them came out first, and that was Esau. And as the firstborn, he would have had the larger inheritance, probably double the amount that Jacob would receive. His father's very wealthy. He'd inherited so much from Abraham. He's got lots of flocks and herds and many servants. And most of this was going to be going to Esau. But Jacob wanted it. And he's found this way of trying to get it. You see, Jacob was often thinking about the future. But not Esau. He's quite dismissive of this birthright. He's famished. All he can think about is his immediate hunger. And so we read in verse 32, "Look, I'm about to die," Esau said. "What good is the birthright to me?" Now, the alarm bells ought to have rung, because not only is he despising his birthright, speaking it down of it, but then Jacob says, "Swear to me first. I want you to swear on oath that I'm going to get the birthright." Now, he doesn't know what Jesus taught about letting your yes be yes and not making vows and so on. It's a very serious thing when you swear on oath. And even at this point, Esau does not take heed. He just goes straight ahead. We read, "So he swore an oath to Jacob, selling his birthright to him." Now, he wasn't about to die, at least physically. But spiritually, Esau was forsaking God. Because as the firstborn, not only would he inherit the bulk of the estate of his father, but also Esau as the firstborn should have been the one to carry on Abraham's name and inherit those promises. That through him, all the nations of the earth would be blessed, that he himself would become a great nation. And this is why Hebrews 12 describes Esau as godless. It wasn't because he had a good attitude to money and thought, well, I don't care about money, you know, let others have the money, I want God. No, no. He was despising his birthright, and with it, he was despising the promises that God had made. And the fact that he can so easily make this vow to Jacob shows that he'd never really valued who he was as the grandson of Abraham. You see, this moment of hunger became a tipping point in Esau's life. He never recovered from this. Remember what it says back in Hebrews chapter 12? Afterwards, as you know, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. Even though he sought the blessing with tears, he could not change what he had done. Later on, when Isaac comes to bless his sons, it's Jacob who again, through his scheming, gets the blessing. And Esau is heartbroken. He's missed out yet again. But it all starts here when he despises his birthright. Now, I'm not saying that we can never turn around after a bad decision. After all, we've all made bad decisions at different points in our lives. But there is a big warning here. Because just as Isaac had to believe in God for himself, so Esau needs to learn to believe in God for himself. Esau needed to take hold of God's promises to Abraham and see that he should inherit those promises and he should inherit the birthright and he should carry on living for God. But Esau fails to accept the blessing of God's way. And later, when he wants the blessing, it was too late. It's interesting, you know, only at the end of this story do we learn that this was only lentil stew. There wasn't even meat in it. Esau describes it as red stew, and we read at the end, then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. It's so pathetic, isn't it? He sold his birthright just for some lentil stew. For a bowl of simple stew and a piece of bread, Esau has turned away from God. It's like in Proverbs 6, where we read of the fool who goes to a prostitute for the price of a loaf of bread. Instead of treasuring his father's commands, that fool impulsively takes the path to ruin. For a moment's pleasure, to satisfy a moment's craving, he goes to ruin. Now, young people, there is a battle that is going on in your heart. And it's a battle between God's way and the world. And you can see the attractiveness of both. You see the attractiveness of God's way. You see in your parents, you see in other Christians, some of the blessings of believing in God, knowing God as your Father. You can see some of those blessings. It's a good life. God's commands are good. The hope that we have as Christians is wonderful. And you can see some of that blessing. But you also see the attractiveness of the world. And it's like this hunger. And sometimes you feel famished, like Esau does. And you long for that. And so there's this tension between the two in your heart. If you go after the world and follow impulsively those things of the world, it will soon be gone just like a bowl of stew. Esau ate and drank, then got up and left. It's almost saying he's left everything. For a moment's bite of stew, and then he leaves everything. Don't let your life be like that. Don't follow the impulses, the rashness of simply running after fleeting pleasures. Don't live for the pleasure of the moment, only to have tears of regret for eternity. Esau later was in tears. He was angry with his brother Jacob. He grieved what he had done, but he couldn't change. Let me urge you, when that battle rages within, each time, ask God to help you. Ask him to open your eyes to see the goodness of God, of God's way, of following Jesus Christ as your Savior. Let's pray.